to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa Prison Break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel Operation. In September of last year, six Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa Maximum Security Prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the six prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The six escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila. At a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemeni suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of three British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed Al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from Al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters. But choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth. Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that a price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I've been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Birri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed, and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light, that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st, but al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr, but those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden has been the most vocally pro-union president in generations, perhaps since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Democrats hope that his strong stance will erode the appeal of the Republican Party for old-line union workers. Donald Trump, however, exploited rifts between union leaders and the rank and file, positioning himself as a champion of blue-collar workers, even as he attacked union leaders. "Spend more time working, less time talking," Donald Trump tweeted at the president of a steelworkers union in Indiana in 2016. We now take a look at President Biden's speech at the Summerfest grounds in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on Monday, 5th of September, for a Labor Day event, and whether the Democrats can win back the blue-collar hearts that fell for Donald Trump and reverse the decades-long exodus of working-class white people from the Democratic Party. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has this to say about President Biden's pledge to be the most pro-union president in American history during a speech in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on Monday, 5th of September. Joe Biden used a Labor Day speech in the battleground state of Wisconsin to endorse the expansion of unions, reiterating his election promises to be the most pro-union president in American history. The U.S. president argued in Milwaukee that a skilled, unionized workforce would help the United States regain its place as a world leader in infrastructure and manufacturing. Drawing on Franklin Delano Roosevelt's explicit support for unions during the New Deal, Biden said, I'm encouraging unions. We need key worker protections to build an economy from the bottom up and middle out. I'm sick and tired of trickle-down economics. Earlier, on Monday, 5th of September, Joe Biden came out in support of a proposed law in California, the Agricultural Labor Relations Working Choice Act, currently on Governor Gavin Newsom's desk, that would make it easier for farmhands to organize into a union. The least we owe them is an easier path to make a free and fair choice to organize a union, Biden said. The Labor Day holiday in an election year typically marks the start of the final sprint before the November vote. With so much at stake in this year's midterm elections, Joe Biden and Republican leaders are revving up the rhetoric. There is also fevered speculation about whether Donald Trump will announce before the midterm elections a fresh run for the Republican nomination to recapture the White House in 2024, while he is embroiled in a host of criminal and civil investigations from New York to Georgia. In Wisconsin, Joe Biden again attempted to distinguish between the type of mainstream Republicans whom he has previously worked with and the extreme right MAGA Republicans, the Trumpies, he said, who pose a threat to democracy and economic security of America and embrace political violence. His use of the word Trumpies lit up social media. Biden in office has largely avoided referring to his predecessor by name in public or talking direct aim at his loyalist voter base. But last month he referred to the phenomena of extremist Republicans hewing unshakably to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again nationalist agenda amid encouragement of political violence as semi-fascism. Then last week, said the United States was in a battle for the soul of the nation. On Monday, 5th of September, Joe Biden said, "You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-democracy at the same time," referring to defenders of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by extremist Donald Trump supporters, hoping to overturn Biden's victory. Biden continued on the campaign trail from Milwaukee to Pittsburgh for his third visit to Pennsylvania in a week, underscoring the importance of the swing state, which the president, a Pennsylvania native, won back from the Democrats in 2020. Donald Trump, who won Pennsylvania in 2016, rallied there on Saturday. After months of dire polling, the signs are more positive for Joe Biden and the Democrats after a spate of legislative and policy wins. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to overturn the right to abortion also seems to be galvanizing the Democratic base, independent and swing voters, especially women, which could hurt Republicans at the polls this November. The New York Times explains more about the issue, saying, "Detroit is known as a capital of organized labor in America. A legendary 113-day auto strike in Detroit in the 1940s helped make health care coverage and pensions the gold standard for employers nationwide. But this year, a notable strike in Detroit happened in a coffee shop, not a car factory. For more than 150 days, baristas refused to return to their posts at the Great Lakes Coffee Roasting Company, a popular chain with a main spot in Midtown Detroit, where the owners showed their respect for coffee farmers in Brazil and other countries by writing their names on a blackboard near their beans. During an outbreak of COVID in January, the baristas demanded protective gear and tests. In February, they decided to form a union. Their strike was part of a flurry of new union activity across the country that Democrats hope will translate into more votes this November. Since President Joe Biden took office, there has been an uptick in petitions to form unions, and today public approval of unions is at its highest since 1965. Mr. Biden, who pledged to be the most pro-union president you've ever seen, deserves some credit for that. He isn't shy about using the bully pulpit to promote organized labor and wasted no time putting labor-friendly members on the National Labor Relations Board. In August, an emergency board he appointed helped reach an agreement that would award 15,000 railway workers a hefty pay rise. But that doesn't mean that middle-class Joe from Scranton, Pennsylvania, is winning back the blue-collar hearts that fell for Donald Trump or has reversed a decades-long exodus of working-class white people from the Democratic Party. Much of the new labor organizing is taking place among white-collar professionals who already lean towards Democrats. Architects in New York, graduate workers at Yale University and employees of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee on Capitol Hill have all attempted to establish collective bargaining units. Workers at an architecture firm in New York on Thursday formed what may be the industry's only formal private sector union in the country. The Yale University graduate students are still trying, and the Democratic staff members are part of the Teamsters now. But what is clear is that Joe Biden has been the most vocally pro-union president in generations, perhaps since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Democrats hope that his strong stance will erode the appeal of the Republican Party for old-line union workers. Newsweek has covered President Biden's speech at the Summerfest ground in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from a different angle. Newsweek reported, Milwaukee voters applauded President Joe Biden on Monday, 5th of September, after he stopped to address a heckler while delivering a Labor Day speech. A video of the exchange, which took place at Milwaukee's Labor Fest, was posted to Twitter by a user named Asin, and has garnered over 44,000 views and hundreds of comments. As I said last week, we remain in the battle for the soul of America, Joe Biden told the crowd before being interrupted by the heckler. The audience booed the heckler, but Joe Biden told them to let the heckler go. Let him go, Biden said. Look, everybody's entitled to be an idiot, okay? At one point during his speech, Biden issued a warning about extreme MAGA Republicans in Congress who are full of anger, full of violence, hate and division, Fox News reported. The comments come directly from a speech he made last week called The Battle for the Soul of the Nation. Speaking then from Independence National Historical Park in downtown Philadelphia, Joe Biden warned the nation that MAGA Republicans are threatening the very foundations of our republic and are determined to take this country backwards. MAGA forces are determined to take this country backwards, backwards to an America where there is no right to choose, no right to privacy, no right to contraception, no right to marry who you love, Biden said. They promote authoritarian leaders, and they fan the flames of political violence that are a threat to our personal rights, a threat to the pursuit of justice, to the rule of law, and the very soul of this country. I ran for president because I believe we were in the battle for the soul of this nation. I still believe that to be true, Biden added.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
I'm honored to be elected leader of the Conservative Party. Thank you for putting your trust in me to lead and deliver for our great country. That was UK's Liz Truss opening statements on her election as Prime Minister and the party leader. But what kind of country will she inherit? Is she aware of the depth of the economic problems that the UK is facing? And more importantly, how to deal with it? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the challenges that the new PM faces and also look at how the UK has fared under the Conservative Party as a whole. First, to get some reactions from what is happening there in the UK, a correspondent from London, Syed Purza, joins us. We'll say that at this point, the verdict is in terms of what has occurred. Tell us how people there are reacting to this, and of course, briefly about what Liz Truss has said in her opening remarks of accepting this.
Well, the general public is divided, really, along Queen, who thought that Rishi Sunak was more clear-eyed on the economy, as you would expect a chancellor to be, and then others who supported rather Liz Truss, because of what people would call boosterist economic plans, her package of support for those in need to try and mitigate the blow from the soaring cost of living and soaring, skyrocketing energy prices. But the fact of the matter is that Liz Truss is faced with a formidable task, a formidable inbox. You're looking at skyrocketing in that is almost nearly certainly in recession. You have the war in Ukraine. You have the unfinished business of Brexit and also the Scottish independence ambitions. All of those things with a very short runway for Liz Truss between before elections. Whether or not he will be able to deliver on those is a question that only time will answer. But, and perhaps another reason why she was selected by that small minority of the British electorate, the members of the Conservative Party, that number between 160,000 to 200,000, was that they were looking probably for someone as ambitious as Liz Truss, who could perhaps, in their view, could unite a deeply divided party, especially in the wake of years, and also deliver on these economic plans, as she said in her acceptance speech, deliver, deliver, deliver. We heard that word so many times. Whether or not she will be able to do that is something, as I say, is a matter of time. But also on the question of unifying the party that remains very divided, she now belongs, although a former Liberal Democrat, belongs to the right end of the Conservative Party. Of course, we'll see her announce her cabinet in the next 24 hours or so, and the makeup of that cabinet will tell you whether or not she is a unifying figure or a divisive one. And right. So, again, on these are the things that really led to her victory. And also, as I say, people are divided on whether or not she will be able to deliver in the coming 2 years.
Thank you so much for that. Syed Purza, our correspondent from London. Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Robert Ulz joins us. He's the executive director at Impact International, who joins us from London. Also joining us, Tony Gostin, historian and journalist, who joins us from Gloucestershire. Didn't pronounce that right.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, very good. Robert Olds, welcome. Let me first start with you. I was trying to find some positive comments on Liz Truss's nomination here, going through online media, but I was not able to find many. I'm wondering what camp you are in terms of what has occurred, her nomination to be the prime minister.
Well, there is an opinion poll out there which says that of all the possible people who would have been leader of the Conservative Party and, of course, Prime Minister, the one best placed and the only one able to and actually possibly likely to beat Keir Starmer. So Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Labour Party, is Liz Truss. She has, to a degree, connected with the British public. Of course, the British public are still yet to learn a lot about her. And, of course, Liz Truss is someone who's been on a political journey throughout most of her life, and it's led her to a position now where she is the Brexiteers' choice as leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And of course, she's connected with many people who are culturally conservative, that do not go, to people who do not subscribe to some of the bizarre views that emanate from certain sections of the society. She's quite, in a sense, conservative socially as well, in terms of having common sense beliefs regarding issues to do with gender. So this is actually some very good signalling that she's done. It's connected with the public, and that's one of the reasons why she is now set from tomorrow to become Prime Minister succeeding Boris Johnson.
Okay. Tony Gosling, I think you'll agree that one of the first things that Liz Truss needs to do overall is, and who knows how she's going to go about this, is to tackle the cost of living crisis. I mean, that's a huge mammoth of a task. Do you think that she is up for it? The correspondent, however, made a good point that she's going to introduce her cabinet tomorrow. But we have to wait and see who she will introduce. But overall, how do you see things?
Well, I don't think she's got really any solutions to the cost of living crisis, and she doesn't want to have them. I think the game she's playing is that she wants to concentrate on foreign affairs, a bit like they do in the United States, in order to try and distract the public from their incompetence at home. But she's definitely not the Brexiteers' choice for Prime Minister. She's originally a Remainer, and there's a survey done by YouGov last week looking at who Conservative voters want. And Liz Truss was the bottom out of the three. They gave them the chance to look at either Boris Johnson to come back or to have Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss, and she's right down the bottom. And the reason, that was 18%. Rishi Sunak had a 20% and Boris nearly 50%. So there's a big impetus within the Conservative Party and amongst Tory voters that's saying, actually, neither of these candidates are better than Boris Johnson. They're looking at the next general election, who they think has got the charisma to win and fight that election, and they believe that Boris has it. Now, Boris has got other plans. The deep state may also have other plans for Boris to go and become Secretary General of NATO, tempt him away from the fight with a big job like that. But the problem with Liz Truss is she's actually not very smart. She's a bit like a kind of ventriloquist dummy who will say whatever is put in front of her. We had a horrible showing of her. This is as part of the campaign, at the beginning of the campaign, where she was trying to find her way out of a press conference room, but she didn't know the exit. But she was trying to tough it out as if she did. Now, this is a very... And she looked really stupid trying to get out of this room, but she didn't actually know the way out, and she was trying to pretend she did. Look, this is a very dangerous kind of psychology to have in a prime minister that tries to pretend they know what they're doing when they don't. I don't think Liz Truss is going to be in charge. She will be being told what to do by the financial oligarchs and the people who are really in charge, and her script will be being written for her. She will have something And she had this, as we saw at the Foreign Office, when she was at the Foreign Office, something called imposter syndrome, where people find themselves in jobs they're not really capable of, and yet they try to, tough it out. They try to, they're basically completely reliant on their advisors. Now, the Tory MPs, by the way, at the weekend, there was a plot revealed in the Mirror newspaper here. There's a whole load of Tory MPs out there who are not happy about Truss winning either. They will, of course, for the cameras, for the time being, saying, oh, yes, we support her, we have unity. They're, of course, hoping for jobs in her cabinet. But there's a MP's plot to bring back Boris in a winter vote. That's what they're saying anyway. Liz Truss is not very bright, they say, and has poor judgment. She has little empathy and she sees everything in financial terms, which is dangerous. What that means is she's amoral. Her values are financial. They're not moral.
Okay, go ahead. Robert Uhl, go ahead.
She's Sunak, who's an ex-Goldman Sachs man, and as Chancellor of the Exchequer, actually put up taxes on the least well-off, targeting national insurance, essentially a jobs tax, on the least well-off. He was all part of the redistribution of wealth from the poorest to the very richest in society with his lockdown and, of course, the measures which created an inflationary boom, which essentially, again, a tax on those who are the least well off. So he was very close to the financial centre, of course, having worked for them and, of course, didn't actually produce the goods for the economy that we hoped. What we do need is somewhat experimentation, relaxation of excessive regulations. We need to get businesses moving. We need to open up the earth to get at the shale gas and, of course, the coal reserves, which Britain has in abundance but have hardly been touched since the 1990s. And we need to become energy independent, and that would be one of the steps to taking the measures needed to reduce the price of energy, which is largely behind the substantial cost of living crisis, problem. Which is hitting people now.
Go ahead, Tony Gosselin.
Britain has a major problem in that we don't actually have any proper regulation. What we're seeing now, I mean, over in France, by the way, the government has regulated the energy companies to minimise these price increases. But here in Britain, we just let them price fix. We let them charge whatever they want.
No, we had a cost. We had a cost cap, and it was the part of the cost cap structure was that it was alleviated over time, and it's just the cost cap has been reduced and got rid of at a time. When, of course, energy prices have become soaring. So we do have a regulated energy sector. What we need to do is have more competition.
These powerful energy companies are running the show. They are actually...
Absolutely. We need to break them up. Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to increase supply. We need of the resources that we have in the UK rather than importing,
well, how much time will that take?
Gas and energy from overseas.
You talk about shale gas, Robert Uhl, aside from the fact that that's an environmental hazard. Let's put that aside. You disagree. Okay. But how much time will that take in order for this drilling or whatever technical approach is for shale to be extracted in terms of the duration of time? Are we looking at the resources being there, A, and B, of course, for it to actually get executed?
Well, one of the reasons why energy is so high is because, of course, there is profiteering from the energy companies, and this is a worldwide phenomenon. One of the aspects we can do is, of course, break them up. But a lot of the time, energy is bought in advance and futures are bought. If we were to send powerful signals out that there's going to be an increase in supply, then the long-term cost of energy will come down. We can increase exploration in the North Sea. We can increase the number of licenses about what can be extracted. There needs to be a whole set of supply side and demand changes as well. We need a radical reform of how the economy has been structured. Because
Let me ask you, Tony Gosselin.
A really simple solution would be to bring these back into public ownership, that run them more openly, and also to have government department. Up until the Thatcher years, we never had these sorts of problems with gas prices because we had something called gas boards that used to sell gas to the public at the same price as it came out of the ground. There was no casino in futures and derivatives and people betting on the price of gas going up and down.
We're not energy independent. We're reliant on a worldwide market and the worldwide price of gas.
Well, we've got to move on past the energy.
Relying on electricity.
Sure. Let's move on past this. Let's move on past this. And I'm going to kind of ask my energy question and try to apply it to other areas where Toni Gosselin, she comes out and she says, within 1 week, I will make sure that there is an announcement on how we're going to deal with the issue of energy bills. And I'm sure she's got plans within that short time frame of announcements. Why didn't she make those announcements under Boris Johnson earlier?
Well, look, the most amazing thing about this contest between Sunak and Truss is that they haven't actually told anyone what they're going to do. And although Rishi Sunak did make an attempt to do it, Liz Truss has said, well, just hang on, and once I'm in, I will then tell you what I'm going to do. That isn't a proper election at all, is it? I don't think she's got anything particularly important up her sleeve. The only thing which will make a difference is the government beginning to act. And what bothers me is that the energy companies are completely in charge, and the government doesn't really seem to have any cards on the table. If you remember last year, we had massive fuel shortages in Britain just at the time of the party conferences, and the energy companies wanted us to believe that they couldn't afford to pay drivers to drive to the petrol stations. No, they were sending a very clear message to the politicians in the party conference season, who's in charge in Britain. Now, if you actually look at where she's come from, and of course, Russian gas is very cheap. We should be taking that. Of course we should. But she wants to have a confrontation for the Americans with Russia. We don't want to have a war in Europe, a fight in Europe for the Americans. When she went to visit Moscow in February, just before the invasion of Ukraine with the Russian special military operation, she had a conversation with Sergei Lavrov, and he explained that facts just bounced off her. So it's almost like people are waving a hand in front of Liz Truss's face, and there's nobody in. That's because she doesn't understand the issues, and she doesn't feel capable to actually make these decisions at a big international level. The decisions will be being made for her by the City of London, by the big investors, and most importantly, by the people who pay for and fund the Tory party.
Robert Ulz, I want to ask you a question here, and I really to really get an idea from you where the UK stands economically. We know currently there's a lot of factors that have dealt with it, but it's not just the Ukraine conflict that has contributed to this, and it's not just the pandemic which has contributed to the somewhat of a hole that the UK finds itself in economically, but rather even before that. But are we looking at a situation when we take a look at the world economy that is also suffering in many respects? How can this Liz Truss deal with the situation that the UK is dealing with? Do you see a way forward?
Well, there needs to be changes similar to those introduced by Margaret Thatcher, which created a more competitive economy and took Britain out of the doldrums. There was a lot of pain before the success actually started to unfold. There's a number of problems that are indeed worldwide issues that, of course, partly have been self-inflicted by many countries through the oversupply of money, through the lockdown measures, and the economic aspects that were used to alleviate the pain the government's forced on the economy by excessive lockdowns. There's also, of course, there is the energy issue as well, and Russia is a factor. But of course, Britain's not going to be as badly hit as other European countries, and the future that Germany is facing, the immediate future, where Russia has essentially stopped gas supplies to Germany, prevent at a time when they would want to be building up their reserves for the winter, means that they, you know, Britain's got a cost of living crisis, and we've got a cost of the energy crisis as well.
Right.
But we are going to actually have the energy. Should people actually be able to pay for it, other European countries may not even have the ability to keep themselves warm this winter, and that is deeply alarming, and that's going to affect everybody.
Toni Gosselin, you heard I when Robert Ulz said Margaret Thatcher, I saw you shaking your head right away. Go ahead.
Well, look, because Margaret, what we're doing now is we're paying the price for the privatisation, the putting into private hands of the infrastructure of the country that Margaret Thatcher did. But there's another major problem that Liz Truss has got to face here at home, and this is why I think she's going to be focusing
on energy and these environmental measures.
she's going to be focusing on foreign stuff, because she's not dealing with the major problem we've got at our hospitals, which is queues of ambulances waiting outside the hospitals because the hospitals are full. The reason they're full is because we have messed up social care, that there is nowhere for the care people, that it's very difficult to make care arrangements for people to leave hospital. So the hospitals are full to bursting, and the ambulances cannot deliver their patients. They're waiting for sometimes 24 hours outside the hospital. Now, Liz Truss is going to scrap the tax changes which were being introduced by Rishi Sunak to alleviate that and to sort out this social care once and for all. We do have to have a mixed economy. This is key. You've got to have some government stuff. For example, a National Health Service, I'd like to see nationalised railways.
We're still buying the energy from abroad at market rates.
I'd love to be able to finish my sentence. And also water and electricity and gas in public hands. This is infrastructure.
Okay, very well. Let me get Robert Olds in. He wants to make a statement here. Sorry to interject. Okay. Robert Olds, go ahead.
We certainly need reform in the energy market, but whilst we have measures in place which prevent us producing, the UK producing its own gas and coal, and has political measures in place which are largely subsidising through the taxpayer and higher energy bills inefficient forms of energy production, such as onshore and offshore wind farms, or of course burning wood chips instead of coal, then of course we will be reliant on importing energy from overseas, which will be through an energy market, and we don't control the price for that. So what we need to do, of course, we need to break up these energy companies, have more competition in there in the energy market as well.
That's what we need to do.
There are solutions. There is a But of course, whilst we buy energy from the international markets, then of course we'll be paying the international price, which is high for everybody at this time, unless one does a sweetheart deal with Russia.
Have you seen the record profits these private companies, energy companies, have been making over the last year? They're the biggest, highest profits ever, and this is all going to the shareholders and the fat cat bosses. That energy should be being supplied at cost.
It's going to pension funds. It's going to it's going to the pension funds, which have invested very heavily in them. So, of course, this is profiteering from the energy companies.
Yeah, I just want to get one point in here about what's going on within the Tory party. And I said at the beginning about the potential leadership election that some Conservatives have quietly told the Daily Mirror before the end of the year. I think it's absolutely deadly serious. A lot of Tory donors, too, are not happy with Liz Truss being in charge. So in a way, there's going to be, I think, a quiet civil war going on within the Conservative Party to remove someone as they see as too dim, too much of a puppet, too incompetent to actually run the country.
Okay.
A petition of nearly 10,000 members.
Let me get Robert Olds. Sorry, Tony Gustin, because we're fresh out of time. Robert Olds, you have the last say. Go ahead, Robert Olds.
Yeah, there will not be a change of leadership before the next election, and Boris will be off enjoying making too much money as a celebrity and a journalist and a writer.